You're tuning in to the Black Hollywood Live Network, featuring news, interviews, and commentary on all things Black Hollywood. Hollywood redefined. From Los Angeles, California, presented by Maria Menounos and streaming live thanks to Akamai Technologies. This is Black Hollywood Live, 100% real. Featuring in-depth discussion on movies and the art of filmmaking. Black Hollywood Live, Hollywood redefined.
You're listening to Black Hollywood Live.
And now, the host for Black Hollywood Live, 100% real.
That song is epic.
Hey, what's up, everybody? You're watching Black Hollywood Live, 100% real. I'm your host, Dario Kristen, and here joining me today is Siobhan Hughes.
Hi there. How you doing?
Tiana Hobson.
Hello.
And Courtney Stewart.
Hello, everybody.
And we have a very special guest today who's going to help us review our movie is Teresa Renee White. Excuse me, Dr. Teresa
Renee White.
Let me get it right.
Hello, everybody. So nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And if you guys don't know, we are going to be reviewing 12 Years a Slave. So if you have not seen the movie, I would suggest that you find something else to listen to or watch, because we are going to be probably giving some spoilers, even though we want you to tune into us still. But, you know, I just want to give you that spoiler alert.
Come back later.
Hit pause. Go see the movie and then come back.
And then come back. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And watch us like five
times.
Like a plan. Yes. All right. Well, we're going to get right into it, because we want to give you guys a full evaluation of the movie and really let you know what it was all about. I will start off with the actual kind of overview of the basis of the movie, which is a story of Solomon Northup, who was a man in 1853, a black man who actually was pulled into slavery against his will in D.C. in 1841. He worked on a plantation in the state of Louisiana for 12 years before his release. The first scholarly edition of the Northup memoir, which he wrote, was co-edited by Sue Eakin in 1968, and carefully retraced and validated all the accounts of his story in slavery. So it's been, you know, really well received. We all were pretty much excited to see the movie and to see what the adaptation of the movie was going to be. It has a luster of stars who have been pulled together to play several roles in the movie. I'll read a couple as highlights. Chiwetel Ejiofor, I never can pronounce this man's last name.
Ejiofor.
Chiwetel Ejiofor, who plays Solomon Northup. We have Michael Fassbender as Ian Epps, Paul Giamatti, Theopolis Freeman, Lupita
Nyong'o
as Patsy, a slave, Sarah Paulson as Mary Epps. We have Brad Pitt as Samuel Bass, Alfre Woodard as Mistress Harriet Shaw, and Quvenzhané Wallace as Margaret Northup, just to name a few. The film was distributed from Fox Searchlight and in the U.S. and Summit Entertainment internationally. The film runs about 133 minutes long. Dolby sound for those of you who are kind of like the techie sound geeks who want to know. Like to throw that little fact in. But the movie opened on October 18th and has been very well received. The audience, I think, for us, I would say that it pretty much caters to everyone. I mean, young and old can see this movie.
I would agree. I would agree.
Yeah, it doesn't have an age limit on it. It's all about learning the history and the facts about the film. Some parts are harder to watch than others, but, you know, it definitely is something that I think everyone needs to see. Some of the other facts I have is that the movie was actually directed by Steve McQueen. You may know him from films such as Shame, which also starred Michael Fassbender as well, and a movie called Hunger. And these are a couple of comments that he had to make about the film as well initially. He said, this is one quote, "As a filmmaker, I was interested in illustrating the history of what slavery was all about, which was a slave labor." He said, "So at the same time you're following Solomon's adventure of trying to get home, in the background you simultaneously see the horrors and pains of what slavery was all about." Another quote from him was, "The story's not just an African-American story," which a lot of people think. "It's a universal story. It's a world story," he says. "My parents were from the West Indies. My father's from Grenada, which is where Malcolm X's mother was born. My mother was born in Trinidad, which is where Stokely Carmichael, yeah. The man who coined the phrase Black Power, we should know that, Black Power, was born. Sidney Poitier was born in the Bahamas. I'm part of the people displaced by slave trades. I'm part of the family. It's our story. It's a global story. And I say that this movie definitely represents that because you learn so many pieces of the different characters. And I feel like you fall in love with the characters in the story. We are going to move on to a little bit more about the character breakdown of the film, which Tiana is going to deliver for us.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start with the white people.
100%
real. I'm going to start with the white people. So first we have Michael Fassbender, who plays Edwin Epps, Epps is described as someone who's driven mad by his own brutality. He's a man who's frying his own brain. He's terrified, and Chiwetel. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay. He says that, I think Solomon, seeing Epps, is terrified of ending up like that, of ending up losing his mind in this place, because one thing that we see about Edwin is that he's constantly going through the struggle of, he's the master, and, you know, he's supposed to hate, you know, his slaves, but at the same time, he's completely drawn to Patsy and he can't quit her. No matter what he tries to do. Mm-hmm. So
he's actually in love with her, and he hates himself because he is in love with her.
Yeah.
Because it is, you know, from his vantage point, it's such a disservice for him to even like, let alone be in love with a slave.
Mm. Yes.
So he hates himself for doing so.
And this is something that, you know, happened a lot. You know, the masters were always kind of going in. They had free reign over the female slaves, and the female slaves could do nothing about it. So you see Patsy, who's struggling with this whole situation as well. You see Mistress Epps struggling with the situation as well, because as the wife, you see your husband lusting after a slave.
Yeah.
And, you know, any woman would be kind of driven mad by that, I think.
Yeah. Did you guys ever hear about the redheaded slaves of Monticello?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
Could you imagine seeing
but
little redheads?
But you should explain to the people who are listening who have not heard of that.
Oh, okay. Like, you know. Well, it's just basically, you know, Thomas Jefferson. Love the sisters. And you know, it was well known but not spoken of that he was basically creating children with Sally Hemings, one of his his slaves. And as a result, there are all these very mulatto looking children running around with red hair during this time, which, you know, it looks very bizarre. People, you know, have visitors coming in and you see redhead slaves. So
that's
very interesting,
nice
part
fact
of history.
Nice little fact there.
There's one thing that I just wanted to go back on for a minute, Dario. I think you said Washington. I think that he was in Saratoga.
Yeah.
He was
Saratoga.
From Saratoga, New York.
Right. He was kidnapped in Washington.
Yeah. Yeah, right, in 1841. Right, yes, and sold into slavery from there. Yes.
Right. And it was based on autobiographical.
Yeah, it's a fictionalized adaptation
of
the 1853 autobiography,
right.
12 Years a Slave by Solomon Northup. Right.
Which was a bestseller, actually.
It was a bestseller.
Back 1853 was a bestseller.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Right.
That's huge.
Pretty significant, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there,
who
it
knew?
Actually, who knew? Yes.
That's a really big question.
Yes, who knew?
How did we not know?
That's what Steve McQueen said. How did he not know about this story after his wife told him about it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How did he know?
So we have Edwin Epps, who's kind of the not stereotypical, because that is how most people were, but he's the master who, you know, is all about discipline and the slaves fearing him and whipping and violence. And then you have William Ford, who's played by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yep.
Ooh, there are some names in this movie.
There are some names,
I tell you. Who is kind of the opposite, where he's the pastor, so he kind of feels a little bit more. He's a product of the situation where he feels bad about this. He tries to keep Eliza with her children. You know, he is the nicer slave master who we often hear about.
Yeah.
He treats Solomon and his skills as a violinist and craftsman with respect while wrestling the contradictions that their relationship presents, because he does kind of show Solomon a lot of favor. Which upsets a lot of his foremen. You know, I think out of everyone who Solomon came across, he's the one who really knew this guy's not supposed to be here. Solomon never really said it, but you could tell that William Ford was one of the guys who's like, there's something different about this guy here, so I'm going to give him more of a voice and a chance to show me his stuff.
Right. It's still such a contradiction, though, because even though he was nice to him and he recognized that he was talented, I mean, he still...
Enslaved him.
Yeah. And he didn't have any problem, you know, having the young daughter taken away from the mother.
No.
Yeah.
You know, in just to maintain his financial security, really. So it's a real contradiction for him, the sort of nice slave owner.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There was that in and of itself is a contradiction.
The moment when Ford was, Solomon was laying on the ground and he was trying to explain. He's like, I'm not supposed to be here.
Right.
He's like, don't tell me this. I cannot know this.
Yeah.
What would have happened? I mean, would he have Ford himself being brought up on charges? Or why is it such a thing if he truly respected Solomon? Why would he not want the best life for him?
And probably because of the wrath.
One of the reasons, but I think because of the wrath that he would have received from the people in his town.
In the town.
Mm-hmm. Right, the disrespect that he would have received. He probably would have lost some jobs. He probably would have lost some opportunities.
Yeah.
So he didn't want to be seen in that light, in that community. That's how I took it.
Gotcha. And his family was in danger, obviously, because he's not supporting this guy who wants to lynch him and not trying. He doesn't necessarily want him to die, but he also doesn't want to risk himself or his family for this slave.
Yeah, because I mean, obviously in those times, I mean, if you were a Negro lover, you would suffer the same consequences as the Negroes.
Absolutely.
So.
That's true.
Well, there's that guy who married, I know you're going to get into that probably, bring on that, like the man who married one of his slaves, who freed a slave and then married.
Alfred Woodard?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to, if we can at some point discuss, you know, how that was even possible.
And I will say that there was a law enacted, the Freedom of Slavery Act, I think it was, that was a law where if a white man did help a slave escape or do anything, they would suffer fine,
the fugitive
prison.
Slave Act.
Yeah, the fugitive slave act. That's the one. Not freedom, because they're not free. Duh. So then we have, speaking of, you know, everything that happens on that plantation, Paul Dano plays John Tibbetts, who was the guy who sang the song. Are we saying it?
Let's just say it. Take the power back.
The Run Nigga Run song.
Yeah.
Which I found kind of disturbing. To hear that, and you know, it made me feel like I was in their place, because you know, you hear about the stories, and it's one thing to hear these stories, and I know that a lot of us grew up hearing them, and even more so than what's taught in schools, you know. Black kids hear the stories and we get a good retelling, whereas, you know, white America usually gets the filtered down version. But even still, hearing the song and watching this movie kind of really hits home, and it's incredible.
There's also that point where, like, Solomon, rather, when he's listening, they focus in on Solomon's face, and you can see in his eyes, like, he's like, wow, I'm here. This is my life now. What's to become of me? It was like, you could see in his eyes. He knew it was just awful.
Well, just the fact of, I'm sorry.
I was going to say it was amazing, because much of the story is told through Chiwetel's eyes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, the very, 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 very long shots.
Yeah.
And you can almost, you can feel what he's thinking. You can hear him thinking just through his expressions. He's such a terrific actor.
Yes.
You know, which is one of the reasons why I think the movie is such a terrific movie.
Right. Yeah. And then just the fact of that he had his freedom prior to.
Right.
And then the fact that, you know, he wakes up chained and doesn't really know what even happened. Mm-hmm. Theoretically, throughout the night.
Right.
And just that feeling, I mean, that was such an emotional moment to watch in the movie as well, because we take things for granted. Right. We are free. We were all born free. And to watch that on screen and to think about the emotion that Solomon had to go through, because he was living a life with his family, his two kids, his wife, and to have all of that taken away from him instantly, and to almost... Not that he felt like he was above it, but he was above it,
and I think he felt it.
And
he felt that.
And
it makes it so fascinating to me, like, because it's such an interesting concept that still kind of applies now. The idea that he wasn't, because he knew different, he was able to see that perspective and try to get beyond it. or wanted, know that there's something beyond right. it. Mm-hmm. And to know that that something beyond it is something worth fighting for. Mm-hmm. As whereas the people, and they kept saying it even when he was with the guys going down on the riverboat, and they were saying how, you know, most of these niggas are not free. Like, they don't know what that is. Yeah. And there's nothing else that they know. And you hear all the time about people saying, well, why didn't the black people just revolt and, like, just kill everybody? Mm-hmm. It's because a lot of them did not, especially once the slave trade stopped and they were being born on plantations because they were breeding the people. Like, they didn't really have a concept of what that other thing could be.
Yeah. Yes, and, absolutely true.
And it's interesting how, to me at least, that is an interesting sort of concept to think about in terms of where black people are today. Mm-hmm. And knowing mm-hmm. what they can do and what they can aspire to be.
Yeah. Because even, you know, slaves would run away and then they would be so petrified once they got away because they didn't know what to do with themselves.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
They didn't know how to live. They didn't know how to be other than working for someone else. They didn't mm-hmm. have the kind of skill set. They couldn't write. They couldn't read. So even if you were to have an opportunity to run and actually get someplace where you are free, then what? Now what do I do?
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's the same kind of thing that is happening today, particularly with young people. You know, they mm-hmm. get into the world, and then they wonder, well, what am I going to do?
Now
and they turn to violent kinds mm-hmm. of things to sustain themselves, or negative kinds of things, because they don't really know how to operate in that kind of environment. So there's lots of parallels there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because slavery was also, it wasn't just a physical binding thing. It was an emotional and mental, psychological.
You know,
they had the slaves trained to be fearful.
Absolutely.
The song Run Nigga Run was actually a black folk song. Mm-hmm. It was started by the slaves, and it was supposed to be kind of like a warning, you know, because they talked about the patrollers who would come around at night. And so this song got started as a patroller song. It's like, mm-hmm. you better run before he comes and gets you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you're going to run, you better run, you know, or the patroller's going to get you. So there's that going into it too, where they, even if they wanted to run, they couldn't because their mental state was that this is where they're supposed to be, and they were too fearful to try and do something about it.
Right. Well,
it's the part with Mistress Epps. She even brought that up. She was like, you know, you let these slaves get the better of you. Do you want this to come back to us in the middle of the night in our beds?
Mm-hmm.
And in that moment, I was like, yeah, why don't they just... They outnumber them. There's mm-hmm. what, like maybe at night, like five white people in the house, mm-hmm. and there's how many of them? So that brought it. I don't know. Just made me think.
Yeah, but in that scene, there were certain scenes though, like where Solomon was when he had the chance to leave, when she asked him to go to the grocery store,
mm-hmm.
and he had that moment in the woods where he was going to leave, and then those guys were about to lynch the other two men. That will change your mind
very quickly.
What
am I doing?
So
very
it's like, quick. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of the slaves had that fire to want to mm-hmm. go mm-hmm. against the master, mm-hmm. massa, you know, massa, but you just didn't know. You could go through the woods and there's something else going on with another slave, and you get mm-hmm. caught in that, and next thing you know, you're going to get lynched. Mm-hmm. So,
and it's a psychological abuse. It's kind of like the battered wife syndrome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, she knows it's a horrid situation where she is, but there's something, you know, about leaving, getting up the gumption per se to actually get up and do something and leave.
Yeah.
And so when you're psychologically traumatized, I mean, I don't know if the psychological trauma is almost worse than the physical, because you just, your mindset, you can't even calculate what I would do, how I would do it, mm-hmm. why would I leave, and what am I going to do when I get out there? And I think it's the same kind of feeling. A woman goes home and she gets beat every night. Slave gets beat every night. But then she can't move. She's frozen. She can't leave.
It's unimaginable.
It is unimaginable. Yeah. And unless you were free, and as you said, and then you know what's on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Or like with the character Patsy, when she, there was a moment in the film, if you have not seen the film, you will see it when you watch it, but there's a moment where one of the slaves, Patsy, goes to leave to just get soap because she's unable to wash herself. Mm. And it took, I'm going to say it took her balls to be able to leave mm-hmm. and run off to the next house to actually try and get soap, because she, I think at that moment, she didn't care that she was going to get possibly in trouble or lashed, which she did. Mm-hmm. It was, her mentals have been broken so much that it was just like that forget it, F it moment. Like, whatever happens, happens. I'm getting this bar of soap to clean myself because I've been deprived all of that, all that freedom.
Especially probably, picking 500 pounds of cotton every damn day.
Right. Yeah, in that shower, yeah. Man. Right? Yeah. At least she probably felt empowered, too, because she was going to Alfred Woodard's home.
Yeah.
You know?
Because yeah.
Mm-hmm. you could see when they were sitting at the table together how she was really admiring her.
Put her finger up when she was drinking her tea.
Exactly. Yeah. So she probably felt safer.
Safer, mm-hmm. Yes. Who she didn't feel safe around, though, was Mistress Epps. Yes, Mistress Mary Epps, who was played by Sarah Paulson.
Wow. American Horror Story.
American Horror Story. Yes. No. Sarah actually had this great quote about her character. She said, "This is a woman who, to me, just doesn't have the capacity to reach beyond her own emotional, spiritual, and psychological limitations. She was raised by bigots and has a certain set of beliefs that are going to be unchanged no matter what, because she's just not smart enough to have it be any other way."
That's powerful.
That is powerful.
Yes. So Mistress Epps, you know, we've talked about it already. She's struggling with her husband and Patsy's relationship. She clearly does not like Patsy and shows it in many ways. One of the ways, I was doing a lot of research about this, and one of the ways that the wives did kind of get their retaliation, because the wives didn't have a lot of rights in these days, the white mm-hmm. wives. So none. They couldn't just go get a divorce or really confront their husbands about it. The only way they could do anything was to lash out on the slaves themselves. That was the one thing that they had the power over. So you see Mistress Epps a lot in this film take her anger out mm-hmm. with her husband on Patsy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true too. It was also interesting the way she treated Massa. Mm-hmm. Because she, in several scenes, she emasculated him.
Yes. She did.
She made jokes about him and mm-hmm. made him feel very small. And I think in several scenes, he was inspired to do something because she was teasing him.
Well, even
aren't you going to do something?
Scene.
Aren't you going to take? Exactly. Yeah. Even yeah. the soap scene. Several scenes.
Yeah.
So it was interesting that I found that a bit of a stretch, because I don't think I've ever seen that in any films before where the mistress is actually mocking the massa in front of the slaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they took a little bit of liberty with that one.
Yeah.
I thought Sarah did a great job.
Yeah.
She
did.
I believed her.
She's very believable.
I believed her that
she
was evil. She was very believable.
She never plays characters like that.
Not
I've never seen her
play
a negative
character.
Always
the nice,
she's always sweet. The direct opposite end of the spectrum. It was shocking to me.
But it was great.
It was great.
And just a couple other of the white characters that we saw. We saw producer Brad Pitt in it as Samuel Bass, who comes in as the Canadian who eventually saves Solomon, writes him his letter, and gets him out. There's mixed reviews on Brad Pitt being in the movie.
Yes.
I personally did not think that he was necessary for it. I found him kind of distracting to the overall feel, because it's like, okay, we're in this moment, and then boom, there's Brad Pitt, and just didn't blend that well because he is such a name. But I know that other people had other opinions about it.
Well, there was a mixture. Like you were saying,
there was
a mixture. Because some people were saying, even some of the criticism was that he looked Amish in the
yeah,
movie.
He did.
And that was distracting.
Not Canadian,
for
so he was supposed to not look American.
Right. he looked very American.
I felt like Brad Pitt, you know, he needed to put himself in the movie. He's producing it. He mm-hmm. needed to be involved in that. And I felt like, you know, he has so many diverse children. He needed to go home and say, listen, babies.
I've been in a slave narrative.
I saved the slave. I saved the slave. Angelina, I saved the slave.
Right, saved
Let's go adopt
children.
20 more multi-ethnic children.
So do you actually think that he really needed to be in the movie?
Needed to be? No. If he was not in the movie, would it have made a difference to me either way? No, mm-hmm. but I think that he was, I really personally feel like he was making a statement for himself and for his family. That's just my own personal feeling.
Well, there was a lot of stunt casting in this film. I mean, we were talking about it earlier. You know, there are people, very well-known actors, who are in it for like, what, 2 minutes tops?
Right.
Paul Giamatti.
Paul Giamatti.
Mm-hmm. In it for a minute.
Very short. Alfred Woodard.
Exactly.
Yeah. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Part of it, I think, is a marketing tool.
Exactly.
I mean, the moment you say Brad Pitt is in the film, naturally it's going to cater to a different audience. They didn't say that he was in the film for, what, eight minutes?
Yeah.
But the fact that he's in it is going to be a draw, a significant draw.
Yeah.
I think for that reason alone, he should have been in the movie because there's people that'll go see it because Brad Pitt's in it, and they otherwise would not. I don't want to see a slave movie. Like,
And it puts it in a different market.
Yeah.
But just in his performance, though, like, it was just kind of dry. His voice just, Brad Pitt's voice for me has always been not one of philosophy. It was just very, I don't know.
It sounded flat. Like he was trying to sound different.
I don't want to hear that you're trying to sound different.
Well, I think he was trying to bring that Canadian accent.
Oh, is that what that was? That makes sense. Apparently it didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wasn't as bothered by him. Mm-hmm. I wonder what was cut from the work that he did, because my issue with it is that it felt tossed in quickly at the last minute without, like, it just didn't mesh. Like, one minute it was awful, and then suddenly Jesus appears. Like, literally, the carpenter with the beard, and that, it resolved in the last, 20 minutes of the movie. So I think for me, it was more, because I have to believe, I mean, maybe not, I didn't see the script, but I would feel, it felt like there was more that was shot, and then the way they pieced it together just didn't work for
me. He was in the middle of doing reshoots for World War Z at the time, so
he was tired.
He didn't have much time.
He didn't have much time. That was struggling a lot. I'll talk about that in a minute. But he was coming back and forth, so I see that. But it's kind of the first time I saw the movie. I saw the movie twice. First time I saw it, Brad Pitt kind of bugged me, but not as much. The second time I saw it was when it really bugged me because I was so in the moment, and then boom, here's
it was
Brad
very
Pitt,
jarring,
and it's like. It's Brad Pitt in the middle of a slave.
I wish they had put Garrett Dillahunt, who played the white man who was living in the slave quarters. I wish they had given that role to him. Because, I mean, I just feel like having a name in that role is kind of distracting.
Yeah, but you already have Michael Fassbender. If you need a big white name, there it is right there.
A big white name.
If you need a big white name, then there it is.
He's also not a cash draw like Brad Pitt.
I wasn't so taken aback by Brad's presence. Maybe because I like Brad.
It's always
nice. We're always nice to Brad.
Exactly. All right, so let's talk about the black folks.
All right.
So we have Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Ejiofor.
Oh, dang, I'm so close. I've been practicing all day. As Solomon Northup, who, as Dariel said, is a free man sold into slavery. We start off with him with his family in Saratoga, New York. You know, a very distinguished family, very well known throughout the neighborhood and treated properly, and then, you know, boom, his life completely takes a 360 turn and not for the better.
Right.
He's thrust into this situation and he has to hold his tongue the whole time because he's a free man, but he can't let anyone know, because that's the first piece of advice he got from one of the people who was being sold with him, was don't say anything about knowing how to read, knowing how to write, or else it's just going to make your life even worse. So he has to keep this in. And I think he does such a great job, like you said, that, you know, we see the internal struggle throughout him throughout this whole film. And this film really relied a lot on him, because I think there was maybe one scene that he's not in throughout the whole film. And that's just when Patsy and Master are outside. But, I mean, he's still kind of...
inside.
Yeah.
Literally in figure.
Literally. Yeah. Literally. Oh.
Okay. Here we go.
Here we go. Yeah. You get the 100%. Oh, my.
So it's definitely something... He carried this movie in my eyes.
Oh,
and
God, yes.
And absolutely. He did such a great job at doing it that...
Excellent.
I mean, Dariel, you said this before we came on. You know, we saw The Butler... and we thought that was amazing. And then you come and you see 12 Years a Slave and you're just like, what, Butler?
It was mind-blowing,
I know. That's the first thing I said when I walked out. I said, I'm so sorry, Forrest. Yeah. You're just not going to get Best Actor. You're just not going to this year.
Yeah.
He shouldn't.
But he should still be nominated.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And there are certain cast members who definitely should strongly be nominated from that film as well.
From The Butler?
Yes.
Oh, sure. I think even Oprah was going to be.
She's going to be.
Oh, absolutely. She should be.
If she is not nominated for Best Supporting Actress, I don't know what I'm going
to do. But I wanted to ask you your opinion about when you first started to talk about Chiwetel Ejiofor. him living in Saratoga Springs, I'm sorry, Saratoga, New York, a well-to-do family. How did you guys respond to that, the way that he was moving about in the city? I mean, we are talking about 1841, and I know, of course, we have the North and the South, and certainly there are free folks in the North, but the extent to which he would wear, you know, the dapper clothing and be in the restaurant, sort of dining, and you could see a few people in the background, some other African-Americans, just sort of dining freely and casually, probably to the extent that we do so today.
Yeah.
What did you guys, how did you guys respond to that? How did you guys feel?
I was, what's the word? I don't even know. I was surprised. Mm-hmm. And whereas I understood that there were smaller communities of Black people, sure, that were free and doing, mm-hmm, professional jobs and doing, mm-hmm, things, I still, the amount, I of, mm-hmm, guess, of freedom was a little bit, yes, more like, yeah, the ability, like, to go into the store, right, and to be, and there was no level of passive, I'm Black, you're, mm-hmm, white, mm-hmm, like there was, yeah, none of, mm-hmm, that, or at least I didn't feel any of that, yeah, when they were, yeah, at home, mm-hmm, at all. It literally felt like it was, if it were a full Black neighborhood at the time, which obviously, mm-hmm, wasn't. They interacted with, mm-hmm, white people constantly, mm-hmm, and it was perfectly acceptable and normal. And from what I get, I mean, the wife, I guess, was going to some week, like, vacation-y area.
She was going to, yeah, job, cook, to cook,
yes, or, yeah, what have you. So they obviously, you know, she, in service industry, and still, but they had their carriages, like, mm-hmm, everybody, they were, they living as white people, yeah, were,
absolutely,
living. And I did not know, I still would have expected a certain level of
prejudice.
Yeah.
Prejudice.
There were no lances. There were no side eyes.
Like, yeah, there was none of that. And, mm-hmm, I found that fascinating. Mm-hmm.
I found it to be a bit of a stretch. There may, okay, be some poetic license taken with that. Mm. I mean, like you said, there were some free, you know, African Americans living in that, in the North. Yeah. But for him to, when he went to the store to buy the, what was he buying? Was it yarn? He was buying
it, was a bag for her to take her.
It was almost as though they flipped the script. Mm-hmm. The person that was the store owner was catering to him.
Yes.
So, that's, so it's almost like they flipped the script, like a well-to-do white, yeah, man came into the store, yeah, and it's like, oh, well, let me get what you need. Yeah. And he's sort of running around acting like a little slave boy almost. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I still am questioning that. But one of the challenges that we have is that there haven't been any sort of autobiographical works talking about that particular experience.
Exactly. That's true.
Mm-hmm. So we don't really know if that were in fact the case. It just feels like somewhat of a stretch for me because we're talking about 1841.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Theresa, about that portion. The only thing that I could think about, because we had kind of had this discussion after we saw the film, is that because of where the film goes, mm, when he's in,
right,
mm-hmm, is pulled into slavery, mm-hmm, they needed to show the polar opposite, right, of that to, yeah, really have the audience feel like, okay, that we believe that he, mm, had this other lifestyle, and that's totally stripped from him.
That's true.
So I felt like they kind of overextended that portion a little, mm-hmm, bit, definitely, mm-hmm, but maybe it was for the portion of telling the story.
Right.
So we, mm-hmm, really fully grasped and have the, mm-hmm, concept of, okay, this guy really did have, mm-hmm, the life equal to white Americans at that time, and that was, he was totally stripped of that. He became, mm-hmm, such a minor person.
That's
after
true.
That portion.
That's true. The layers of loss,
the
I guess.
Layers of loss.
The family,
yeah,
the prestige. Right, so they did. The juxtaposition between where he was and where he ended up.
And then I,
right,
guess I could sort of believe it a little bit just because it is, you know,
New York.
And it's a melting pot and people are all up on top of each other, even with racism during that time. It, you know, it's, that's where so many other races have come from, just the mixtures from that. So I guess I was able to believe it a little bit just because, mm-hmm, it was New York. Now, if you had told me it was Alabama, that's a different story,
right,
you know.
Right.
But
true.
New York, I could sort of believe it a little, mm-hmm, bit more. I'll say that.
It'd be, yeah, nice to actually see a story about that.
That would be
about
a good,
him.
Yeah.
Maybe you should. You are a documentary maker. You should.
Maybe I should.
Yeah.
Find
those families.
Find those families. That would be a nice story to
tell. That's a great story.
Absolutely.
And then we have Lupita Nyong'o, mm-hmm, who played Patsy. She's a newcomer. This is her first feature film debut. She's straight out of Yale, mm-hmm, School of Drama. Got the part 3 weeks before she graduated.
Right. Yep.
Phenomenal.
Phenomenal. Mm-hmm.
To me, she was the best part of the
she
film.
She is.
Well,
she is one of.
Let me not
she
take away.
Of.
She would tell.
Yeah. Yeah. One of. They auditioned over 1,000 girls looking for, mm-hmm, for this part. She wasn't even supposed to audition for it.
Wow.
Her manager got it for a different client and then thought that she would be good for it. So they put her on tape. They sent it into the director, and Steve McQueen flew her down to New Orleans immediately, and that was a wrap.
I feel, mm-hmm, sorry for that other client.
I know, right?
I'd be mad.
You got a new manager.
You got two of us.
I was saying,
you're a manager.
Yeah.
You just have one.
When I looked for a manager, I was like, do you have another black woman on your roster? No, I'm not going with you. That's how I am.
But Patsy, in the script and in the book, is described as being effortlessly sensual, which I think that Lupita does a great job portraying in the subtlest ways. You know, one of the first times we see her is in sitting in the field making the dolls out of the corn husk, which she actually came up with. Yeah. She learned how to do it, brought it to Steve McQueen, and he loved it. And it shows her childhood like innocence compared to later on when you see her being beaten, or when she Master Epps comes around and, you know, forces himself on her. You have that to go back to, that, you know, she does still have this childhood like innocence, but then she's in these real situations.
She's being stripped of that innocence.
Yes.
How old was she, do we know?
Repeatedly.
We don't know.
No.
I guess maybe 19, 20?
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing.
I have a question.
I thought teenager, yeah.
Yeah, I thought she was like maybe 19, 20-ish in that realm. But I have a question for the panel. I don't know if anyone else noticed this, but so many depictions of, like, you know, inside slaves versus the field slaves show a broad range of colors. They show dark skin versus light skin. Even when you had the butler and Mariah Carey playing the mother of a fair-skinned slave, I did not see in this film any reference to lighter skin slaves at all. It was strictly a lot of the darker skin slaves, even in the house. And I thought that was an interesting... Well, there was one.
Yeah.
But I thought that was an interesting kind of display of colors for the movie, because I just felt like that wasn't even sort of the subject or brought up at all. Because that's during this time period. We also had the light skin
versus the
brown skin outside house, you know, field slaves. And there wasn't, I didn't see that in this film per se.
There was one mention at the, sorry to interrupt, one mention at the beginning when they were being sold.
Yeah.
When Ford wanted to buy the child, the girl, but apparently she was mixed race.
Oh, right.
And so he said, oh, no, you can't afford her. She's going to grow up to be a beauty.
Maybe they were drawing that juxtaposition again between black and white, because it's so very much about race. And so that adds another element to the story, a biracial child thrown in there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what role would that person have had? Or you're saying maybe just having someone in the kitchen, or just something.
I didn't see that. I guess because I've noticed it more in other films, and I didn't really notice it as much in this particular film.
It's a good point. It's a good point.
And I don't know if that was a conscious choice or it just...
I wonder if it was a conscious choice, because we like to get caught. Like, I feel like in the world of fantasy of slavery in film that we have been exposed to, we often have, they want to play with that, because it's the interesting thing, and it's the, you know, and I feel like he was saying, it's not about that. The story's not about that. Right. We're going to talk about the real. We're not going to get caught up in this. Because it gets muddled when the children get involved and watered down, and somehow it becomes, you know, because the kids change things. And
true.
And it makes, and in some ways, it humanizes and dehumanizes the slave masters in a lot of ways. So I think he just didn't, I feel like that would have taken it to another place
level,
that didn't push that point that he was pushing.
There would have been more dynamic between the mistress and house slaves as well. And so that whole her disdain for Patsy, I think it was drawn even larger, more prevalent, because there wasn't any sort of distraction in the house. Because if there was a fair-skinned slave, the fair-skinned slave would have been in the house.
For sure.
And so she would have had to interact with them. You're right. I think it would have digressed a little bit from the story.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe added too many layers. There's so many things going on.
Yeah,
so
and I don't know what
to deal with that.
I don't know what's in his memoir, because I haven't gotten to read it, but I can't wait. Mm-hmm. But he obviously worked in the field, so that wouldn't have been necessarily his perspective of that dynamic. And I'm sure there's chatter in the slave quarters, but it's definitely not what, you know, we get to sit around and gossip about, because there was fear for life. So maybe that also wasn't a part of his perspective as much.
Yeah, it was just the lack of seeing it, and even just seeing any kids out in the field that were born. I just didn't see that at all. So it just was something that I was conscious about in the film.
We did kind of see towards the end, when after Solomon and the rest of the slaves were coming back.
When they were coming back.
Yeah, you know, we did see Master Epps playing around with that little girl.
But she was dark skin.
So, because at first I was like, oh, is that maybe one of his bastards, or I was thinking, but then
she was so creepy. I was like, this is Lupita numero dos, because Lupita is about to die.
Or she's old and groomy.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
She seems very pedophile.
It was very
let's go get some candy.
Yeah.
And he was running around in his nightshirt holding her hand.
Yes.
And it was really interesting how long they decided to hold the camera on that little girl.
Yeah, they made a point for us to notice that. For sure.
That's why I thought he was grooming her.
Absolutely. I agree.
Did too.
Appalled. Mm-hmm. I'm so disgusting.
Aren't we lucky to be living in the time that we're living?
Yeah, even with our issues.
I'll still take it. So then we have Patsy, who's struggling with, you know, not unrequited feelings towards her master. She doesn't want to be with him. He wants to be with her. And then her friend, Mistress Shaw, played by Alfre Woodard, she's a former slave who's married to a plantation owner. This wasn't very common, but it did happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And,
it's incredible.
Yes. And the master who married his slave was usually not really invested in much after that, because mm-hmm. people didn't trust him or want to do business with him because, you know, notice how she rarely had any visitors except for Patsy coming over for tea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was her only company. So I think her role was there to kind of paint the picture of what Patsy's life could have turned into. Mm-hmm. Where we have Patsy over here struggling with everything and not wanting this and suicidal. You know, she wants to end her life and wants to end the misery. Whereas we have Mistress Shaw, who's, you know, got her happy ending, whether she loves her master back or not. We don't actually know, but she knows that for the time being, this is how she can survive and have a better life.
I thought for a moment there was going to be some sort of dynamic between her grooming Patsy in some way to follow in her footsteps, because, you know, she sat there with her cup, you know, what have you, her teacup. You too can be this way.
Yeah.
You know, if I take you under my wing. So I thought that they were going to, you know, digress into that area, but they just let it go. It didn't pan out to be anything. But did you guys get that feeling?
I think they wanted us to believe that. Yeah. I think they wanted us to see that. And then once again, it's kind of like what we were saying before with the other storyline, that they took us there and then to you know, to show the disappointment too.
Right. That's true.
Which is another thing that, you know, this is all based on Solomon's perspective. Right. So to go into that, he wasn't there. He doesn't know. So we have to stay true to the true line of the story, which is his perspective.
Right.
I mean, it'd be interesting as well to see, you know, a spinoff with Patsy's version.
Right. Who would get beat?
Yes.
Why did she get beat so badly?
What happens to Patsy after he leaves? All that. And then just some of the scenes that I wanted to talk about. We've talked about a lot of the ones that were on my list already. But the dancing scenes in the house when Master Epps comes in and wakes up the slaves in the middle of the night because he's drunk and wants entertainment. And this is just another way that he can have control over the slaves. You know, not only do I control you during the day, but I control you at night 24/7. You are mine. And you have to do whatever I say.
Yeah.
They're at his whim.
Exactly.
Puppets.
They're so interesting because there's always this notion about, you know, African-American folks or black folks that like to dance. They enjoy that. And that was the way that they would sustain themselves. So who was being entertained more by it? Is it the black folks or is it the slave masters that were entertained by that sort of, that kind of performance?
I'm sorry. If I worked in the fields for 10 hours during the day in the middle of the sun and then have to be up at the crack of dawn the next day and you come in storming in, waking me up and making me entertain you, I'm not sure if that's exactly the entertainment for them that that, you know, people would like to believe.
Absolutely.
It was, you know, after the sun went down and they're doing it on their own free will, that's entertainment. But when the master comes in and drags you out of bed to do it,
that is not
also not fun to get hit by a decanter by an angry wife too.
No,
or get scratched. She got scab on her cheek and she ripped the scab off of her
and then she got yanked at the floor like it was a midnight of the Apollo night. Like Sandman came and just yanked her right off.
Did anyone else feel too with Sarah Paulson's character who plays Mary Epps that there might, at first I thought there was going to be some type of interaction with her and Solomon, because she the way she was with him, I thought that it was kind of almost like her F you to her husband, like I'm gonna you got your little slave mistress here, I'm gonna get my slave you know, boy here. they didn't, they, it's like they teased us with it, but then we never really saw any fruition of it happening. Mm-hmm. So what did you guys think?
I felt that at a moment. They played with us. They played with the audience to make us think that that's where they would go. Mm-hmm. Probably for the reason that you just cited, because he had his plaything and so she wanted to have hers. And Solomon seemed to be bright. He's handsome. And so there was a moment, and they flipped the script. I think the expression on her face even changed.
It did.
Because she was looking at him in sort of a
almost like a pause.
You're interesting. I mean, didn't she ask him, can you write?
Yeah.
Can you write? Like, she was very interested in him, and then she just turned. She just flipped.
Yeah.
So I did take notice of that.
Yeah.
I wonder why they didn't. Well, then that's digressing.
That's another story.
And I kind of feel like it just furthered her character to not go there because because you wanted her to have a moment where she was like, I can do this too. But to me, it just reinforced her own internal evil and disgustingness because when she asked about him being able to read or write, it turned it into, you think you're something else and you think you're something different. And if I figure out what it is, I will put you back in your place because like, and it just reinforced all of that about her for me. And I was just like, I hate you.
And that's what they wanted us to do. We thought she was very conscious of him at all times too.
Yes, she kept her eye.
She kept her eye on him.
She did.
She was trying to read him.
It's so strange, that concept of like, being punished or threatened for being intelligent.
Yeah.
It's just such a bizarre thought.
But that happens today. It happens today. It happens, you know, particularly with young people. I'm around young people a lot. And so they have to pretend. They're in my space and, you know, I want them to sort of maximize their intelligence or what have you and to turn the light on. And then they do. Oftentimes they do. But then they have to turn it off when they go home because they get shunned. You know, man, who do you think you are? What are you talking? You're talking like the white folks and what have you. So it's the same concept.
That's what happened to me when
they
moved.
They have to downplay their brilliance and intelligence.
When I moved from California to Georgia, I got that same feeling. Mm-hmm. It was like, why you talk so proper, man?
Right.
Why you talk so proper? No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting.
Who do you think you are?
I was just going to say how the fascinating thing to me is when they, you know, they tell him, you know, keep your head down, man. You can't act like you read or write. Mm-hmm. To be conscious constantly of not reading, like you can't, she hands you that list. You can't look at it and see something and be like, oh,
I know.
Like, and you can't go to the store and see, like, you have to keep that in the forefront of, because reading is just second nature. Once
someone
you can read,
right. paper,
you look at
it
and you recognize things. Right. And I just thought, like, when I saw that, I was just like, the whole time, he had to live that for 12 years, like pretending like you've never seen words, you can't form words. How were you that good of an actor? Like, to figure that out. That was crazy to me.
I bet they cut some parts out from that because I kept getting the feeling that someone was going to catch him reading.
Yes.
Or catch him writing. So that was probably some film that was left on the floor.
Yeah.
I'm sure it had to be part of his narrative.
And Solomon wasn't just your average educated. He was like
very educated.
So that's even harder on that level to suppress
that. And a very learned
musician.
Like, they're making him dance. Who knows? There had to be music around. How did he always not see it or notice it? Or that was powerful to me.
It's a good point.
Yes. And then I just wanted to talk about some of the violence in the film because, you know, we have the scene where after Solomon beats up John Tibbetts, you know, his gang comes back and they end up getting him halfway lynched. And then he's kind of left hanging there for hours in the sun, no water. And I loved what they did in this scene, how they just kept the camera there.
Yeah. Right.
And then you see the slaves going about their day-to-day business because this was so common that it was numb to them. They didn't even have to acknowledge that was happening.
Mm-hmm. But they couldn't.
They couldn't
acknowledge it. That's what was devastating. Mm-hmm. Like, he's hanging there and they couldn't even look at him and be like, nothing.
The one woman took a real risk by going
giving
right,
him water.
Giving
him
water, right?
Yeah.
That scene, I think, may have been the most powerful. Maybe. Maybe because he stayed on that scene for so long. Mm-hmm. And I actually felt my feet because he played with his feet, tapping and tapping and tapping and tapping and tapping.
So
you thought it would never stop. Yeah. You know, some of the young people that I spoke with that saw the film, they just felt like they were in the film with him. Mm-hmm. They felt they could feel his pain. They felt thirsty. And I literally start to twitch my feet when I was in the theater. And to you're right, to watch people just walking past, I mean, that's a real, the real contrast between the psychological oppression and the physical oppression, mm-hmm. all at the same time in the same scene, seemingly forever. Forever. I don't even know how long that scene is. I probably should check on that. But no.
And yeah, the fact that he still wanted to live. Like, he was fighting to live.
A lot of people probably would have said, oh,
yeah, I just would have given up. After, like, the 10th hour, even like, oh, you know what?
Just done. Right on the edge of death. Just right on the edge. Like, if I stop, if I lift my feet up for any period of time, it's over. Right?
Yes.
And just scratching at the surface. I think that was really one of the most powerful scenes in the film.
Do you think that he knew eventually that he was going to get his way out of slavery?
I think so.
I think so.
That
and that gave him the will to keep fighting.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, he had to fight to keep his dignity. And because he was bright and he was savvy, even when he talked his way out of getting in trouble with Massa after mm-hmm. he found out that he had been writing letters, the way he spun that whole story around, that wasn't me, that was actually him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was excellent. So I think that he probably felt in his heart of hearts that, oh, this can't be my existence.
Yeah.
This just can't be. I'm too brilliant, I'm too smart, and I'm going to find a way out of this.
Yeah.
And I think that's why when Eliza confronted him about, you know, have you stopped crying for your children? You know, you don't make any sounds, but, you know, I'm letting mine out. And he's keeping it in because deep down he knows he will find a way to survive. He just has to get through this, get through this moment. And then when he sees the opportunity, he can seize that moment to get free. Mm-hmm. So he didn't let his emotions overcome him like Eliza did. You know, you see them both struggling with the same thing because he did lose his children, his family, just the same way she did, not as graphically, you know, ripped out of his arms like she was, like her children were, but they still have the same, you know, sadness inside them for their families.
I mean, you could die from grief.
Yeah. She actually did.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And particularly because he knew better. So, you know, this, which is better, to be born a slave and never know what it's like, or to have had an opportunity to be free and then to be enslaved?
Which would be a tough question. I almost say I agree, ignorance might be bliss because to have that knowledge and power and the thought that maybe you can't get out of it ever, that would kill me.
That would kill you.
That would kill me mentally alone. So if I didn't know what that other life, I'm just living my life. You know, so that's a tough one. That's a tough one.
Yeah. And one of the other violent scenes, or most violent scenes in the film, is clearly towards the end when Patsy is getting beat on that stick, holding onto that piece of soap.
Yeah.
Mm. The fact that you could get the life almost beat out of you because you went to get soap because the mistress wouldn't give it to you because her husband's sleeping with you. To me, in that whole scene, I think that Lupita did such an amazing job capturing the emotions. I felt like my back had been whipped. And the fact that you have Solomon, who's being forced to do the whipping, which is something that also happened a lot of, you know. Clearly, Master Epps didn't have the willpower at the moment. You know, he has his wife screaming at him to do something, prove that you're a man, and, you know, do it. But he still passes it on to Solomon.
I think it was brilliant. I mean, the cinematographer, because, I mean, really, you rarely saw the whip actually penetrate the skin.
Yeah.
What you see is the face of the person beating, whether it's Solomon or it's Massa beating, and it's the sound effect.
The sound effect.
And splat. And every now and then you see a splatter of blood.
Yeah.
Just a little splatter coming out. So I think it was brilliant the way that they shot it. And it was, you know, just the horrid sound of her screaming.
Yeah.
The sound itself was almost as bad as seeing the whip hit her back.
Yeah, and then her facial, like you were saying, her facial reactions to it. You felt the spirit of her dying.
Right.
You really through the emotion of her face.
You really did.
And then also the way that they shot it with the film quality, I felt like I was literally in the field watching this take place while I'm there, you know.
Yeah, and Lupita actually had a great quote about the shooting that scene. She said the reality of that of the day was that I was stripped naked in front of lots of people. It was impossible to make that a closed set. In fact, I didn't even ask for it to be a closed set because at the end of the day, that privilege was not granted to Patsy. It really just took me there. It was devastating to experience that and to be tied to a post and whipped. Of course, I couldn't possibly be really whipped, but just hearing the crack of that thing behind me and having to react with my body and with each whip get weaker and weaker. I mean, it was, I didn't practice it. It was just an exercise of imagination and surrender. And that's exactly what she encompassed in that scene.
Yale Drama School.
Yale Drama School.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They pop out stars.
They did that.
And overall, I think that there is a lot of criticism. I know Daryl and I have talked about this, about the overall violence of the film and how, you know, it's overly violent. Well, not overly violent, but a lot of critics said that it was very violent and you saw a lot. I didn't really
I didn't get that at all.
I think that there's crime fighter movies out there with more violence in it.
Absolutely.
But they did a great job of capturing. And I think what they mean to say is, I had a conversation with a friend. I was like, come see this movie with me. He said, I'm sorry, my white people guilt is way too hard. I can't see that in a movie. I can't do that. And it was in that moment that I realized that I'm used to it. I went to the slave museums. I saw these torture things. I've seen what they had to go through, and he's never seen it. So to some people who haven't been made numb, not made numb, but been aware of this, exactly how it was going down, yes, this is a violent movie for them to sit down and watch. But to people who grew up seeing it and, you know, understand what was actually happening, I didn't think that the movie was really that violent. They kind of numbed it down a little bit.
In Toronto, they actually had people leaving. Because it was just too much. And during one of the interviews at TIFF, Steve McQueen was asked, like, how do you feel about, you know, people just walking out? And he's like, I don't think there's anything really you know, bad about it. And if you ever seen Steve McQueen being
interviewed, we talked about that.
That was a very numbed down version of what he actually did. Right. He's very caricaturish in his responses.
Very honest all the time.
Like the word white guilt, like the moderator used that word. She was like, yeah, white guilt. And he went,
what do you mean?
He did not like that word at all. So this is not a film about racism.
You know, I didn't find it to be violent, and the book, from what I understand, is far more violent. I mean, when you think about the kind of degradation and the brutality that was experienced for, you know, for black folks for 300, 400 years, that was just the tip. It was just the tip of the iceberg. But you're right, there are a lot of people who, let alone have seen that sort of picture, they don't even really know about black history. They don't even know that folks were enslaved and that's how they lived. And so it would be jolting to actually see the living conditions, number one, and to see how they were brutalized on a day-to-day basis. I can see how some people, but that's the overarching theme. Oh, it was so violent. It was so violent. But they have no idea. They have no idea.
That's
it's just a modicum of violence.
Our uniform American ideal cinematically of what slavery was like is gone with the wind.
Right.
It's like that is the, it's so romanticized. So I just
Roots. Yeah, 12 hours.
And even Roots, people are kind of like, and everybody didn't see it, and it was like a black movement. It wasn't like
1972.
The general culture of what.
Yeah, for me, I didn't think it was overly violent, as we were kind of talking about, but what it was more a mental violence than a physical violence.
Right.
Mentally, you know, hell, I would have felt like I got slapped 15 times, but just watching certain scenes. But yeah, I was surprised by what critics had to say about it being so overly, you know, violent, especially when you have like Tarantino movies where, you know, Django.
Yeah, Django was violent.
Even Roots, you know, like, that wasn't as, it didn't make that same impact on me as far as the physicality of the violence. So. All right, is that what you? That's your overall story. Thank you, Tiana.
Overall,
Overall Courtney, story. Courtney, you got some audience.
I mean, we've already gotten into a majority of this already, but okay. Let's just give you guys a quick overview. It opened, as we said, on October 18th, and it was only in limited release. It was only in 19 theaters, and it still made $924,000, which is an average of about $50,000 per location, which was huge. It puts them third in line behind Blue Jasmine and Fruitvale Station for a limited release and how well it did, and it is expanding to 100 theaters this week, actually, so... Mm-hmm. More of you guys out there can definitely go check it out and watch it. They started out, they had a $22 million budget, so they got a ways to go to sort of make up for that, but hopefully it'll be all right.
That was well done for $22
million. For $22 million, they did a pretty good job, and a lot of people came through to help the funding, especially Brad Pitt, so that's why he deserved to be there, show.
Right? Has to have his cameo.
And it's interesting, and just in terms of the audiences, a lot of the smaller art house theaters that were showing it obviously skewed a bit older. It was most of the audiences were 45 and older. But in specifically black theaters, it was a fairly even distribution because we all went to see it. So
did you find that there was more women? I thought I heard that there was
See that actually.
More women went to see it.
Really? I'm actually not surprised by that though.
Why do you think that is?
Because women appreciate deep, heartfelt, intricate stories more so than men.
I think also,
Go ahead, you go ahead.
I was thinking about that because I went and saw it by myself and I didn't want to because I knew what I was getting into. and I needed somebody to like let it out on when I was done. But I had to see it when I could see it. And my boyfriend couldn't go see it at the time. And he is not hype about seeing it. And we had a conversation about it and we kind of talked about it. And I think for him, it would be more difficult than he wants to put into his spirit to see this man go through this. Yeah, and, you know, he's like, I have enough about it. I think that's for, and I wondered when he said that about black men and how experiencing that from a man's perspective and a man, because a man going through that really means something very specific for our culture. So I don't know if that would be why the women were able to stomach it a little bit more and maybe they were okay to go see it, but it's an interesting thought to me.
Right. Some of the young people that in my class actually made them go and see it, but I strongly encourage that they go and see it. And the responses from the young men were so much more powerful than the women. You know, they were mad. A couple of them were mad. They were disgusted. They felt that the director made them feel like they were just too much a part of his experience. And it reminded them of some of their own experiences.
Now, were
the injustice that black men and boys face and how you can be taken out of your environment for not doing anything specifically, the same thing that's happening now with the prison industrial complex, taking young black men away for doing basically nothing. It's the same sort of thing that happened to Solomon. So a couple of my students, they, you know, very astutely made that comparison, and they were just appalled and sickened, and they really, really wanted to leave. I mean, that was part of the cinematographer Sean Bobbitt's intention, is to make you feel like you were part of that experience, to make you feel so uncomfortable. And just when you feel so uncomfortable that you want to leave, then he would cut. And he would see some beautiful scenery.
Yeah.
He even talked about the scenery had to be such an important thing because that was the only thing that gave the audience some sense of relief because it was so dismal and so dark and it kept getting darker. What would have sustained you through 2 hours and 13 minutes were it not for the cinematography and those still shots that made you feel like he was painting a portrait, so to speak. So I think African-American men or black men of color in general, I think because it would probably resonate more with things that are going on with them today and the feeling like we haven't really come that far. I had one of my students say, why did I even need to know that history? Look at what he went through. And we're still going through this today. So why should I even learn about history?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that.
We had to have a talk about that. I stopped my class. I stopped the whole thing. It's like, oh, we're going to have to process that.
Well, Courtney and I have had discussions. We do another show called This Week. And one of the topics of black films that have been released and showcasing slavery and just things in the past, the question came up, or I based the question, like, do we need to keep making these films? Do we need to keep seeing what happened in the past? And I was a strong believer actually before this that, you know what, like, we're moving forward. We have a black president. We're trying to, in order to move forward, why do we keep looking in the past? We can't get there. But after seeing this film, I completely changed my mind with that, because I felt like this is such an important film just for me to see. And to, yes, we are African American on this panel. We know our history. But to still just see the brutality of it in the form that, that Steve McQueen shot it, it really changed my perspective on just the people being knowledgeable and knowing what really happened. Right. Like, yes. What ethnicity, it doesn't matter. White, black, Asian, you know, whatever. You need to see these stories. Yeah, as painful as they are, you need to see these stories.
Well, yeah, that quote, if we don't know our history, we're doomed to repeat it. Absolutely. And we are repeating it. We are completely repeating it. We've been repeating it over and over and over. We haven't reconciled anything about it. And I just, and it's not just black people, which is why it needs to, this is why this movie had to be made. It needs to be seen, like she said, by other people, the white guilt for whatever reason. Like, you need to know that that's what went down, and that would make you less accepting of what's going down right now.
Absolutely.
And it's so frustrating to me. Anyway,
but yeah, also, I mean, it's also not just about like just racism and slavery.
Right.
It's about the human condition of persevering, of of dealing with things, and there are lessons to be learned in the film beyond slavery and, you know, what's being shown in there.
And I like that you said human, because slaves were property. And this really showed the humans that they actually were. Because all in most movies, you know, it's always about how, you know, they were property, their property. And here you really humanize the slaves because they are human beings with feelings, with families, with all these other factors going into it. So I really like that you said humans.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's just so important to actually look back and think about the kind of experience that black folks had back then, because I think a lot of people, a lot of young people or whatever, feel a little bit entitled, a sense of entitlement. And so they don't really understand that they couldn't even be where they are, wherever they are. They couldn't be there were it not for the kinds of struggles that black folks went through. So I think it's a form, a way for them to also feel empowered and to feel like, you know what, I'm not going to let that happen to me. And now I feel more inspired to be the very best that I can be, because I know that those folks back there never had an opportunity to do what I can do today. Whatever they were doing today, they couldn't even do that. Even walk down the street and get arrested for doing nothing. You couldn't even do that because you were somebody's property. So, you know, I can't even articulate the extent to which I think it's so important that you know your history, so that you really know where you're going. You really know what your four fathers and mothers had to go through. It just, it makes me feel like I, first of all, I'm not going to allow myself to be in that kind of situation where I don't respond, or I don't, or I feel like I'm being manipulated by a particular situation, because we didn't have the opportunity before. And the fact that we are here in this studio, look at this. This is progress, significant progress.
You're right.
Not nearly where we need to be or where we were going to be, but it certainly is. We've come a long way. And not knowing that, I think, is just, it's a disservice. It's a dysfunction for young people.
And you mentioned that you encouraged a lot of your students to go see it. I'm curious to know, was there a difference between some of your non-black students and black students' reactions off of the film?
I only have a couple, actually, in this particular class that are non-black. I have a couple of that are of mixed race. But no, it was split more along gender than it was with race.
Okay.
Interesting. All right. Speaking of audience members.
Nice segue.
So we had some people that went out, checked it out. One of those people being Miss Madonna. She,
Madge.
Went to see the premiere at the Walter Reed Theater in New York's Lincoln Center. But apparently it was not holding her attention as strongly as apparently it held all of our attention. And she spent the evening tapping away on her BlackBerry. And supposedly, allegedly, an audience member actually asked her to stop. And she responded by saying, "It's for business, enslaver."
She did.
No way.
What?
I read that. I was like, come on, that's gotta be gossip.
No way.
I did read that too.
I cross fingers and pray that that did not
happen. That was someone trying to sell an interview. That's what that was. That was someone trying to sell an interview to a gossip magazine.
Like, I can't. I don't know, but people do say dumb stuff.
They do say dumb stuff.
But
and Madonna does have a smart mouth.
She does have a smart mouth. She might have thought that was a little clever.
She might have thought that was clever.
She might have thought that was clever.
In another circumstance, that may have been clever. Not marrying 12 years a slave.
Yeah, she also has a black son.
She does have a black son.
I forgot about that.
You know, she get interesting.
And she's a businesswoman. I doubt she would in a film of this nature say
premiere.
Something say something like that she knew would have to, it would get to the media.
I mean but what could have been so important? And you know, she has this new project, the special project Revolution that she's just created, that there's been so much buzz about, and that's all about, you know, expressing yourself and oppression from violence and how we can overcome this and how we can start this kind of revolution. So when I heard that she had done something like that, I mean, I tried to rationalize it.
Yeah.
Who was she talking to?
Yeah.
And why would she do something like that when, on the flip side, she has this whole push toward revolutionizing folks, people that have been discriminated against and exploited, women and, you know, gay folks and people of color.
Yeah.
But then you're seeing something that has such a serious nature, and she's texting. I would like to hear what she was doing and what she was thinking about.
Agreed. Wow.
And also, well, I was just going to put this in, you may be saying this next, but what I thought was interesting about that with the story is that this theater is known for its anti-texting rules.
Right.
So they made it, Madonna may have just been there at the wrong time because they made an example of her, but they're known for throwing people out of this theater for texting in the theater. So that's made it interesting too.
Yeah.
She's such a diva. Could she have been doing it because she wanted us to be talking about her? This whole project
so
that she has, this special project Revolution. I mean, she doesn't need us to talk about her, but no. You know, how do you rationalize it?
Self-absorption?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I
could see her just being in her own world. Like, I need to respond to
I need to respond to
I have to do this. I'm here. It's the premiere. I was photographed with the director. I've done my job as a celebrity. I'm just going to do my thing.
I wonder what scene was on when she was texting.
I can't even imagine, like, how...
Don't let it be the Patsy Whippins
I got a couple calls.
I can't rationalize it. Well, some people think that it was not such a brilliant thing for her to do. Mm. And the Alamo Draft House, which is known for a strict policy with unruly customers, etc. Basically, the CEO, Tim League, had tweeted that until Madonna apologizes to movie fans, Madonna is banned from watching movies here.
She just gets banned from everything.
Yeah, well, and it started out, he said, it started out as an offhand joke. Sort of a spur of the moment, 140 characters, because he was on Twitter, and it was more of a means to get the issue out there that it is rude to text during movies. But he has now decided to stick to his guns, saying that now that it seems to have taken hold, sure, I'm going to enforce it. And he says, I'm serious, but I don't really think it affects her life.
Madonna's going to be fine.
She's
got the art of life. She's good.
She's
just going to stick to
it. She has her own theater. She'll be fine.
Right. It'll work for her. Okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
But point well taken.
Exactly. I'm glad he stuck to it at least and didn't just have a Twitter moment. But as you mentioned before, the Toronto Film Festival had a lot of people that walked out of the screening because of the violence, but there were also the wonderful ones that stayed and were moved to tears, and they stood up and gave that movie a 10-minute standing ovation when it was over. So audiences received it even in all of its pain and harshness. I'm still talking about it here today. I'm like not over it. Like, I needed to I'm not
It's helping to talk about it, but it's still, I mean, the mental state that you walk out of that theater in is so, it's like nothing
Sticks
I've ever,
with you.
It's like nothing Take I've ever felt, felt before. And it opened my eyes to a whole new world. And
it's really interesting because when we saw it, the dynamics of the audience, demographic of that audience, it was probably 1/3. Maybe 1/4 of African-Americans in that room, in that theater. And you know, from what I understand, most people are responding in the way that you just described. some standing ovations. Some people are just sitting in their chairs. You know, yeah. people usually get up out of their chairs and leave. Mm-hmm. They're sitting there watching the credits, and they're just really taken by it. So yeah. I think more people, obviously more people are enjoying it, yeah. even though it is brutal and it's violent, than not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is a good thing.
My theater was fairly small. I went and saw it at the Landmark.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure I was the only black person there.
Were you?
It looked like perhaps a Hispanic couple, I think, mm-hmm. but I'm pretty sure I was the only black person in there.
Yeah, interesting.
And it's interesting to feel the energy of the room mm-hmm. shift mm-hmm. when it happens. And they have couches there, and there was a white girl on the couch with me. Hanging out.
Absolutely.
And
progress.
She was sort of, and I couldn't help but, I mean, it's a white girl next to me, I'm the only black girl. I'm watching what people mm-hmm. react to and do and move, and it just watching her body language, because she started like curled up in her yoga pants, like, okay, I'm watching a movie. And it sort of, it was interesting to watch her sort of relax into the movie, and it's almost like it was filling her. And then when it was over, she was stunned. She was like just flat. Couldn't move, out of breath. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting thought to me that it's that, because it was moving for me, but I feel like we had two different movements on the same couch, and it was just sort of a fascinating thing to watch.
Did you feel any energy toward people looking at you like, oh,
yeah,
discomfort? People uncomfortable?
I wonder if it's me,
black person in
because
there?
I've always been around white people, yeah. and I always feel, because yeah. I was always the kid that when yeah. we had Black History Month, everybody's like, what's going on?
What happened?
So I kind of assume that, so I never know if it's actually happening now or if I'm just assuming that that's what I feel is happening. But I do feel like once I went to the bathroom, because like a bunch of the ladies that were in there went to the bathroom, and I wasn't crying, but I was disturbed. I was visibly and physically disturbed. Mm-hmm. And I felt like they were having a, like, we almost want to
give you a
hug or touch you, but
say, I'm so sorry.
And they were going the stall moment. So I don't know what that was. It wasn't expressed, but it would have been interesting had we actually communicated. I should have said
that. Well, it's interesting you say that about the tears, because one thing I did notice when we saw the screening at your school, Teresa, Cal State University Northridge, I looked at the crowd, and there was not a lot of dry eyes in the crowd. And I also noticed that there were several couples, and at the beginning of the movie they were kind of just sitting, and by the end of the movie their arms were around each other, they were embracing each other more, there were some heads on some shoulders. This movie was so impactful, it affected everybody in so many dynamic ways. I mean that's even with your story, Courtney, I noticed a trend with this, you know, with the way the crowd reacted to it and just people's responses towards it.
That's a tribute to, I think, the director.
Yeah.
The director and the script writer who interpreted this book. So it's a huge tribute to it, because a lot of folks won't go to see this kind of film. And it'll be interesting to see when they have more theaters, you know, the kind of response that we're talking about are, you know, based on 19 theaters, kind of pinpointed in certain areas.
Yeah.
They were chosen specifically, those 19. So now that it's being spread amongst 100 theaters, you said, right? How folks are going to respond, because more demographics are going to go and see it to see how it's received and see if it does as well as we hope that it does.
I think it will.
I think so, too. It's
going to be a
$1,253,000 as of today. So it's making
It's still making money.
It's chipping away.
So 19 theaters, that's significant.
That is very significant, because I didn't realize it was only 19 until I read that, and I was like, wow.
I didn't realize it either until I wanted to go and see it.
That's true, when I looked it up, and it's like,
why is it not playing everywhere?
I have to make a real effort.
Because I thought it was a wide release initially.
I did too.
Or at least wider than that.
And then I thought everyone was racist and just not playing it in their
And then I had to research, limited release.
But it's very under the radar, just even the advertisements of just watching it on television, watching it, you know, watching it online. I didn't see a overabundance amount of marketing and advertising for the film.
Which I'm curious about, because the students wondered, well, why didn't we hear more about this? And I says, well, where would you hear it? They said, there wasn't anything on YouTube. There was no pop-up ads. You know, when we go on Google or whatever we're doing online, we didn't see any of this. We didn't hear it on the radio stations.
Right.
So I'm really quite curious about the marketing campaign. Hmm. What is the story with that? And if it's going to increase.
I think Siobhan later. Might have some stuff.
Moving along. So we already sort of talked about the cast and things that are going on. There's obviously Oscar buzz surrounding it. The critics have, for the most part, giving it A's across the board, for the most part. The biggest complaint I've found, obviously, was Brad Pitt.
Yeah, that's the biggest complaint.
Of all the things.
Of all things, it's Brad Pitt. But I also found it interesting that we sort of had a complaint about Adipero Oduye that played Eliza.
Oh, Eliza.
Which this table wasn't so in love with her work as an actor, but...
What, Eliza?
Eliza. The
crying. It was just the crying.
I just felt like that's all we saw was kind of like a one note with her. And I just didn't feel that this woman truly just devastatingly lost her two children. But that was my personal opinion. It was something missing for me.
Was she overacting?
Possibly. It's kind of hard to put the needle on it, but I felt like I wasn't convinced that she really did just lose her two children separated like that, you know.
It seemed a little dramatic. Not that she wouldn't be deeply grieving, but
sure.
The nonstop wailing. Yeah. Seemed to be a little bit dramatized.
Yeah. A little bit.
And maybe I would need to know her backstory a little bit more because of the fact that, you know, during those time periods outside of Solomon's story, most blacks didn't live like that. Free, and they had to assume that this could possibly happen to them at some point, you know, to be enslaved, unfortunately. So I don't know her backstory. Maybe she had a similar life to Solomon.
She had been a slave.
She was her master's mistress.
Yeah.
And
he was sick. He got sick.
He got sick and died, and she was taken to New York under the false pretense that she was going to give her freedom papers. Her daughter was her master's daughter. So when she got there, then, you know, got right back into the whole slavery chain.
So the devastation of not just losing her children, but she was the one who brought them
into slavery. And she had her own servant, she said. So she was used to kind of a better lifestyle than just being a field slave.
I thought you were going to say it.
I was like, Tiana, say it.
All right.
In my quota for the day. All right,
but there is Oscar buzz, obviously, all over for the actors. Lupita Nyong'o, they think is going to take it away from Oprah.
She'll get nominated, but I don't know if she'll take it.
It's interesting that there will be so many nominations for whoever wins, but that there's going to be so many nominations.
Well, that's what I'm interested to actually see, which we kind of talked about with the Butler, because we were all excited and we're like, there's these black folks everywhere. And to get more than one in categories, are they really going to bring those nominations?
It's time, though. If it's going to happen, it should happen now. These are real films that need to... that are successful enough for this to really happen. Yeah. It's not, let's just give this to someone because they've been in this industry for a long time and we need to honor them. This is, these MFs acted their asses off.
It's not like it's Halle Berry with Monster Ball.
They need to get these awards. This needs to be Black Oscar this year.
Yes, yeah. I think it will be. Yeah, if the Oscars are not a very colorful event, then shame on Hollywood.
Yes.
Yeah. Because this has been a great year with great acting actors coming out of the woodworks. I mean, even Fruitvale Station.
Absolutely.
You know, it's more than just, you know, The Butler and 12 Years a Slave. There are a million other films out there that are so good and are getting a lot of buzz. So if it is not a color for Oscars, and I mean that in, you know, black, white, yellow, purple, like indigo, whatever it is, it should just be it shouldn't be an all white Oscars.
And the Oscars are very politically driven.
Right.
So even from a PR standpoint, you just know that these films are going to be nominated. Mm-hmm. There's no way that they would ever not be nominated.
Because they've diversified the committee. Mm-hmm. And there's a black president, black female president. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how could they not?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. How could they not? Point.
Well, interesting that you say, how could
they not? Another segue.
Because there's a little article that says, gives us five reasons why
it won't.
It may not be. as amazing at the Oscars as we may think for 12 Years a Slave. So the five reasons are kind of interesting. The first one is the Oscar is not, it's not a sprint. It's a marathon, which means it's early, takes time, and they do campaign. Yes. And it is very political, which Michael Fassbender actually spoke about, saying that he ain't doing it this time.
Never again.
Right. He's like, never again. I'm an actor. I'm going to be an actor. I'm not a politician. Mm-hmm. So that, too, is a problem.
Number they say that might hurt the film a bit.
It might hurt the film a bit.
Really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The fact that he specifically will not campaign?
Right. That he's not campaigning.
In terms and of getting the attention.
Right. Yeah. It's true. It's. I mean, you could understand that he went through, you know, so much pain and thinking that he was going to be nominated for Shame.
Shame.
He wasn't.
Which he
but I think
been.
It's because of the topic of this film that people might look at that
look
in
at
a different,
different
way.
Light, yeah.
Hopefully.
Right.
Well, the second one, which I actually found very interesting, has to do with the audience. It's called, it says, Great Expectations, Not So Great. So all of us sort of on the small circuit that it's been out, oh my God, it's the most amazing thing ever. So when people who know nothing about it are like expecting to go see this amazing film, they go in and see it and they're like, okay, it was good, but it wasn't like all that because their expectations have been set so high.
Right.
So that could be a problem. Number three, you can't ignore the screener factor. And basically that means the screeners go out for the people that vote over the holidays in general. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a matter of, if they didn't see the movie in the theater, they're going to take their stack of screeners to friggin' Aspen or wherever they go for the holiday, and they're going to have their families around. And what do you want to watch at the holidays? 12 Years a Slave may not be number one on the list when you got your family around, you're trying to be in good spirits, because it is a moment.
Yeah. I have an aunt who every Christmas watches The Color Purple since I was a child. So that's like our It's every Christmas.
That was a heavy Christmas.
It's a heavy Christmas. But,
we watch Love Actually.
That's what
Love Actually and A Christmas Story. Exactly.
But, you know, The Color Purple, because, you know, it's a great film that speaks to a lot of the stuff too. And I mean, I guess growing up watching that every year, I don't associate Christmas with only being like happy, upbeat movies. I think a lot movies come out around Christmas time that speak a different voice. Gangs of New York came out at Christmas. I remember that because my mom thought we were going to see the other Leo movie that year. You know, and then everyone started dying. Right. So, I mean, movies, like heavy movies, come out at Christmas all the time, so I really don't want that
to be. I don't want it to be, but heavy is heavy. 12 Years a Slave is another kind of heavy.
Yeah. It's a different heavy.
It's a different
heavy. It's like real.
So, yeah.
Like,
but it's difficult, too, because, you know, strategically thinking about marketing and positioning, a lot of films that come out at the end of the year are nominated more often because it's fresh in people's minds.
Yes.
I mean, we can't remember what we saw in February.
Right.
What films did we see in February?
Exactly.
Right. So that's
part of it
in terms of timing.
Number four, which we sort of alluded to earlier, Steve McQueen is an artist. He is not a salesman.
Nope.
So there's quite a bit of concern about him sort of being on the circuit and being a brown noser and being able to do that versus being able to be Steven.
It's a very combative interview.
Yeah,
I'd be very afraid to interview that man.
Would you?
Just I would. Be
researching
terrified.
This and watching some of them and reading the transcripts, I was like, oh no, that would scare me.
He's interesting.
And that's unfortunate that it is, to Fassbender's credit, that this is a whole marketing ploy that, you know, you have to be out on the circuit and talking to folks and trying to convince them about the film as opposed to just taking it on the merits of the film.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you don't have that sort of buzz, maybe you don't even have that sort of budget to be out there. Takes a lot of money, lots of energy, lots of time to be on the circuit,
and you have to have
marketing
the
your film.
Plan B will take care of that for them. Plan B will pay for that.
Right.
That's all
true. They are having kind of a good year with
Right.
That's true. That's true. And last but not least is the obvious. We haven't seen everything yet, and lots of things come out at the very end of the year, which you kind of already mentioned and sort of have in the past. Things like nobody had seen Million Dollar Baby until, or The Aviator, or Sideways until like later in that year and took away. So there could be something that swoops in.
Watch
out, because Anchorman's coming out at Christmas.
I just saw it in my class, you know, with all the boys. Best Man.
Yes.
Best Man
Holiday.
Holiday.
Nonetheless, it has already won quite a few awards, as it deserves already. Mm-hmm. So if it wins or it doesn't win, I'm glad it got made.
And we're talking about it.
And we're talking
about it.
And I actually have a couple of the awards that it's already previously won. The Britannia Awards. It won for British Artist of the Year. Hollywood Film Awards. It won for Breakthrough Directing. Breakthrough Directing and New Hollywood Award. For Mill Valley Film Festival, it won Overall Audience Favorite. And for the, as you mentioned this earlier, I believe, Courtney, is Toronto International Film Festival. It won the People's Choice Award.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's got its award buzz.
Yeah.
I wonder about the Golden Globes, how it will do there.
I think it'll do well.
Yeah.
I think it'll do well. I think that's actually where it will probably rack up. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
most of them.
And mm-hmm. I'll be interested to see, just in terms of acting, Sarah Paulson and where she sort of falls, mm-hmm. because Lupita's getting a lot, obviously. Mm-hmm. She did an amazing job. But I really think Sarah did some miraculous things role that made me really fascinated with how she did what she did.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I read somewhere that Lupita, though, would be considered for supporting actress.
Yeah.
So that would be in the category, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that would be.
Also, too, with Sarah Paulson, I guess the argument would be like, well, she wasn't in there that long. But then we had Dame Judi Dench win.
Yeah,
exactly. What was Shakespeare in Love? For mm-hmm. she was in there for what, 3 minutes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you never know.
I haven't really watched her. She's in American Horror Story. You said
yes.
That.
Yes. Yeah.
So I haven't watched her. So was this a real stretch from what you've seen before? So in terms of her acting ability, her acting chops, did she really stretch her character? And would she then be worthy from that vantage point?
From what I have seen of her, to cast her in that, I would have not thought of her.
Really? Yeah.
Okay. That would not. She would not have come on my list. Yeah. I would not have thought of her.
I wouldn't give her that deep evil role that she had to pretty much embrace in this. Mm. You know, like just the mental kind of way of being able to have the slave beaten and have no emotional connection to it at all. Yeah. She's normally not.
Hmm. And the fact that her character didn't come out of it and have some sort of transition where she turned for the good. Mm-hmm. You know, she just remained that person.
So and she might have a chance if that's the case, because oftentimes when you stretch and you go out of character, that's when people recognize you, like Denzel and Training Day.
Mm-hmm. All right, is that your overall audience reception?
That's
there,
my overall everything.
All right, Siobhan, you have a couple of facts and comparisons.
Well, we were talking about the festivals and the marketing and that kind of stuff, and that was actually with the film Fox Searchlight wanted to take advantage of the film festival circuit. Mm-hmm. They wanted to gain momentum off of the buzz, take the like slow and steady almost. So it premiered at Telluride, and then they went on to TIFF, where they won their award. They also wanted to give the film some time to find its African American audience. Mm-hmm. So, no surprise that of the 19 theaters, those theaters were opened up in like predominantly what they say is urban areas.
Crenshaw.
Yeah, LA. that's where I went to go see my film. Like, yeah, and it's a stereotype, but it's true. We do talk to the screen.
Yes.
It was definitely a very interesting. Yeah. Yep. Especially when Whippin' was going on. It was a very interesting theater.
What happened
in the theater? During the Whippin' scene? In the theater?
It was just like I had some very vocal women behind me, like three of them. Mm-hmm. They're just, oh, I can't believe she just let that happen. It was very like, I don't know, like three catty old women sitting on the stoop, just like, you know, which, I don't mind so much. I mean, sometimes in certain dramatic moments, it can pull you out.
Mm-hmm.
But I still like to know what people around me are feeling and thinking. So that's why I don't mind going to see movies there. That's why I always go see all my movies.
Yeah. I usually go see it somewhere first.
Right. And then you go over there.
You know, you want to actually hear the movie.
You'll miss half of it, right?
It just depends on the film that
I want to see.
If I don't really need to listen, I just laugh.
Right.
I'll go to the Black Theater.
Right. Absolutely.
Horror films. Don't open
it 100%
real. I can't believe she's going to
throw it. But they did it. They purposely did like, you know, urban places like LA. Can LA be considered? But New York, DC, Chicago, Atlanta, of course. And they kind of did a mixture of art house theaters and those Magic Johnson theaters. So the ArcLight, of course, here in Hollywood did very well. Let's see what else. What we were talking about, how in terms of like the audience, if they were going to be receptive towards it, just purely because of the violence. They accounted for that. They thought about that. And that is something they were worried about. Mm-hmm. And I know from my personal standpoint, when I first saw the trailer, the first time I ever saw it was during The Butler, when I was waiting to see The Butler. Mm-hmm. And which was very smart because it's the same demographic, same people that they're trying to get to go see the movie. And I was like, well, that looks really good, you know? Maybe I'll wait for Redbox, you know, just because I knew it was going to be good, but I just didn't want to go to see a movie, spend my money to feel sad and upset and, you know, so those are things that they were thinking about, but I don't think that, I think the word of mouth is going to save it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think they chose wisely. I know you said that it might not be smart enough to do it because a lot of movies can come out between now and then. But
they're giving it a slow build because, you know, they have the limited release and then it's expanding and then, you know, 100 theaters, if it does well, they could expand it more.
Right.
So, you know, it has the longevity factor where it could actually roll into December because we're already at the end of October.
It's November.
Right. Yeah, it goes way later. So, you know, it can roll over and it will still be in theaters come early December at least. Mm-hmm. And so more people will still be going out there.
And it's like having multiple releases because I almost felt like the movie was out already when it was at the film festival when Toronto was happening because I was like, wait, did I miss it? And because I am on the SAG committee for the SAG Awards, so I got the invitation to go see the screening, but then I found out the movie wasn't coming out actually until October 18th because we weren't doing. I'm like, wait, that's like a whole month and a half later. So then they got another movement now that they can release to bigger theaters. So I think that it'll be a constant sort of, it's an opportunity constantly for them to sort of premiere the movie, and it's kind of a cool
and also
way
just
to
people like tweeting and just when they're seeing it, like when I get out of a movie, if I'm moved, I'm tweeting about it. I'm on social media about it. And, you know, all your friends on the, you know, in certain cities that are following you, they have the opportunity to get excited about hashtag 12 years a slave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they're trying to capitalize on that audience of tweeters.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what we saw at, because they, Fox Searchlight actually called our department, Pan-African Studies Department, and they were doing that across, I think across the country. Mm-hmm. So they're going to colleges and actually screening it. And that's what we saw in the
smart.
The Omid Reader.
That's
exactly.
Smart.
And just
so that word of mouth, sort of more of a grassroots kind of campaign.
A shout out though to Lupita, who has actually been, this seems very surface, but wrecking it on the red carpet in ways that people are paying attention, which only draws more attention to the film.
Yeah.
And
she's
been
beautiful.
Doing
it
everywhere.
It helps if she looks like an African god.
Right.
She wears trash bags.
Amazing. Yeah. But the fashion world and the entertainment world and seeing her
like,
constantly on
girl?
The people pages who's out, like that's just only helping.
We're going to see her on the cover of Vanity Fair. We're going to see her on the cover of Vogue.
Yeah.
Com Award season. Essence. She's going to be everywhere.
Yeah. She's just so adorable in all her interviews.
Do you know what she called herself? She said, she's like, well, I was born in Mexico, but I'm Kenyan, so I'm a Mexicanian. Like, who says? I mean, that's
she's
just
adorable.
So cute.
I think she's already been cast in another film. Well, she's up for one. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the name of it, but I read somewhere that people are already calling her agent.
They are.
And she
will definitely do well as a result of this.
She struck gold because, like, as like a new actress, your quote. Like, you don't, like, you have to still audition. Like, now after this, she won't have to audition anymore. Mm-mm. She will get offers, and her quote will just be jumping from nothing to, like, crazy amounts of money now because of this first role.
I
wonder
so.
How much she got paid this time.
I can't imagine that it was...
$22 million wasn't very much, so
I
can't imagine it was much.
She wasn't a recognized name prior to,
not at all.
So, you know, there's always that certain scale, so...
So screenwriter and producer John Ridley, his attitude on racism in our current culture is not what you'd expect. Basically, he thinks that we're all a little too sensitive. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what you were saying about like looking back and, you know, we should be moving forward. It's like, why are we so affected by other people's stupidity when they show bigotry? Mm-hmm. He says, to me, you walk around with a Klan hat on, you've got a swastika on your arm, you just look like a dope. You know what I mean? You look at things that are happening now in America and you think, well, gosh, we're smart people. Why do we have such a difficult time getting over race? It's because it's been such a part of our culture, perhaps longer than any other country. Up through the 1890s and even through the civil rights era, That was the law of the land. So, I mean, I kind of understand what you're saying. We might be a little too, like, we get a little too upset about certain things that we should be more upset about other things that are more important.
I'm going to disagree with that.
I mean, like, we're
always reminded of race all the time and every moment. So how can we not be sensitive towards it?
Well, I mean, you can choose your reaction towards it. You can go at it with a negative way. Like, God, I don't know. But it's just, I could kind of understand, like, everyone, there are some people who play the race card when you don't need to play the race card.
And I think that we remind ourselves of the racism thing more often than other people are, because it could be an innocent comment from one person where you then take it to that next level where, you know, oh, well, is that a race thing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I know that, you know, you can joke around about it a little bit more now. And I think that we sometimes bring it up more so than other people realize that it's happening, and whose fault that is, that they don't realize what they're saying, I don't know. But I don't think that everything that's said is meant to be taken in a racial tone. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're the ones who are making it more racial than it actually is meant to be.
I think a lot of it has to do on the individual experience.
Yes.
You know, the extent to which he has been oppressed in, you know, whatever form that might be because of his race. You tend to respond to things more if it's been part of your experience, or has it been part of someone's experience that you love, or someone that you've seen and you've been traumatized. So it's different if somebody's walking around with a swastika, or somebody's walking around. What did he say? He said something like a Klan hat on.
Yeah.
Right. It's different if they're walking around and not bothering you, but it's another story when they are actually at the helm of your opportunity and closing the door to certain things for you. Or stalling your progress in some way. Yeah. So they have a larger impact than just being sort of a bystander and standing over there doing what it is that they do. Mm. But oftentimes that seeps into your existence, or it seeps into your lack of opportunity, or it closes a door for you or for someone that you know.
Right.
And so we are facing this. We still face, you know, this is a racist country.
Yes. Still.
And there's the what's called a microaggression. It's the kind of, it's called a daily racism that we don't really know. Mm-hmm. It's that feeling when, you know, the woman grabs her purse when, generally speaking, a black man walks into the elevator with her. Right. Or those comments that you're saying, that you're mentioning. Yes. They may not be intentional, but still they have a racial undertone.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so there's these daily things that happen that we have just sort of gotten used to because we think that's the way that it should be. And it really is not. The person shouldn't grab their purse just because you walk into the room. What does that mean? Or the fact that these two people that were just on the news, they were in was it Barney's?
Yeah.
People in Barney's.
Wait, what happened?
This young woman went in there and apparently she got her income tax check or something, and she went in there and bought
$2,500
purse. And then she was followed and harassed and said she was stealing and so forth. And that was
accused of credit
time.
Card fraud.
Because she had a credit card and it didn't have her name on it.
Right.
And she walked about five blocks out the store and was, and NYPD blew.
Grabbed her. And that was the second time in Barney's, like, I think. Yeah. It was a guy in April that
bought a $300 Ferragamo belt and was accused of having a...
Well, I think in those instances, yes, that is something to be upset about. But he brought up something like, you know, like the Paula Deen scandal, you know? It was just, as he says, it was... God, what did he say? I'm really like, forget about her being an old Southern white woman. Somebody said something dopey about somebody else. I guess it's just kind of like there are more. I hear the exhale.
That's a little tricky because, you know, the N word. I mean, everybody knows that's inappropriate.
It's and that went way deeper than just the N word comment.
That's slavery.
And that goes to the whole like nostalgia of the antebellum South.
Right. And pure ignorance.
It's tough to say.
And it's hard, you know, because people, black folks are, you know, taking her recipes and cooking food, and she's cooking Southern food.
Yeah.
And I mean, I struggle saying that word. So the fact that she was saying
just throwing it out.
And not get it.
That's the real challenge that folks
say things, and then they're like, oh, well, I didn't mean it that way.
Mm-hmm. And to say
how
we're...
How did you not know in 2013?
And to keep saying that we're too sensitive frustrates me because it puts the responsibility on us to be okay with flippant, ignorant behavior. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I'm not saying we need to jump down everybody's throat that right. says something racist. I'm a firm, like, I've had situations with friends where friends have said some mm-hmm. inappropriate things mm-hmm. or
right.
things that, and I know it's not coming from a evil, horrible place,
right.
but it is mm-hmm. coming from an ignorant place, and it is not okay.
Right.
And nobody ever told them, and mm-hmm. they thought it was fine and wouldn't yeah. thought for a second that it would be offensive. So you clarify that.
Right. Yeah.
So I think there's obviously ways to address things, and they're all different for every situation. Right. But to say that we're just too sensitive overall yeah, because right. mm-hmm. 'cause racism is entrenched in this country in ways that we have not even right. begun to
at
try
all.
To Absolutely. Evaluate, address, yeah. or deal with on any level.
And it's not just black people.
And it's not just black yeah. people.
It's not. No, it's yeah. not.
And it's not. The bottom line is, as long as there is one that is in power that can put all your children in jail like it ain't nothing,
yeah.
like there is something mm-hmm. to be
I mean,
dealt
there's
with.
Also to be said for things like... you know, Kendrick Johnson in Georgia. Do you guys hear about
yes.
this story with the young man being found in his gym?
It was in a mat.
In a mat, in a rolled up mat. And so the investigation wasn't handled properly. And a lot of people mm-hmm. think it's just because he's a black male. Mm-hmm. So they had to reopen the case, and they exhumed his body. And they had found that he had been stuffed with newspaper.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So they think it's like a citywide government cover up, you know, things like that, you know, deserve our attention. And then mm-hmm. I think that's when we need to be getting upset. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Farrell, you know, that, unarmed 24-year-old black man in North Carolina who was shot to death when he had a,
yeah.
you know, car mm-hmm. accident, and he was reaching out for help.
Right.
And he was just shot, you know, yeah. things, you know, mm-hmm. that I think that's where our attention should be going. For me, if someone says the N-word, it is upsetting to me. But I see what people say, like, especially like if you want to bring hip hop into it, like taking back the power of the word. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't have that much, the word itself should not have that much effect on us. The person's actions should. That's just personally where I am with that.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, because we're talking about this film too. I mean, yeah. the word is just so charged.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
charged.
It's charged because there's, you know, the degradation that we're talking about based on the things that are happening in this film mm-hmm. that is closely connected with that. I mean, folks didn't even have a name. That was their name.
Yeah. That was their name.
You know, and yeah. so we have that history
nigger.
That we sort yeah. of carry, and it's weighty.
Yeah.
And justly so. And so, but I agree with you with what you said earlier that I don't think that we should, you know, have somebody ruin our day.
No.
Right.
You know, get upset and, you know, change your mood or what have mm-hmm. you. But they do, to your point, need to be called on it mm-hmm. sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Explain that
that's inappropriate, mm-hmm. you know, to say those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, how would they know? Sometimes
yeah,
they just don't know.
It's kind of like, I always like to ask, like,
innocent.
Why, I like to say, like, why do you think that that's okay for you to say?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we said, you had your conversation with your friends about like like certain song, like I would have white friends sing songs, and when it got to that part in the song, first they'd look at me mm-hmm. and then they'd say it and I'd say
approval?
Why did you, yeah, well, just to see if I was going to like be like stop, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not my responsibility for me to tell you what you can say, but it is interesting that you one look at me mm-hmm. and then two, you go ahead and say it anyway. Yes, it isn't a song, but
or they do the opposite of that, where they look at you and then they kind of mumble something over it, and you're, and then I'm sitting there thinking, well, I know when you're in the car alone mm-hmm. and this part comes on,
you say it.
So you might as well say it.
Yeah, so in that position, I'm like, well, if it's okay for you to say when you're alone, why can't you say it when I'm in the car with you? Yeah.
Right.
That's true. I wonder what your face looked like when they said it. Was it just sort of blank or, you know?
When I said the word?
When they looked at you for approval.
No, I mean, I definitely had a conversation with them afterwards, but I really couldn't tell you what my face looked like. I was just more like, it was more of like a confusion of like, or like an anticipation of, is it going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know, there are some people who I am through my life who, when I had that conversation with them, they didn't feel like it was a problem to say the N-word in the form of an art like singing or rapping or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we had to differ.
Mm-hmm.
Now yeah. you also have, there were some other facts and fiction about the movie, did
yes.
you?
Yes. The infamous scene with Solomon whipping Patsy, that did in fact happen. It was, he actually describes it quite well in the memoir. He says, "It's the most cruel whipping that that ever I was doomed to witness," saying she was literally flayed. Mm-hmm. Also, Patsy did on many occasions ask for Solomon to kill her, not just the mm-hmm. one time that was shown in the film. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she also did attempt to bribe him many times as well. The Bass, Samuel Bass, played by Brad Pitt, saving him, getting the attention of people in the North, to come get Solomon. That did happen, but it didn't happen in the quick way that it showed in the film. Mm-hmm. There were many nighttime meetings and discussions about how to go about doing it. Several letters were written. A lot of them were never answered. So, Bass himself went up to the North and, brought people back down to save him. Mm-hmm. And also the fight with, Ford's plan. Sorry?
With Tibbetts?
Yeah, with Tibbetts. That actually, there were two altercations.
Yeah.
The first one, as we saw, that did happen, but the second one involved, Tibbetts chasing Solomon with the axe.
Oh.
Yeah. So those things did happen. Now to some of the fiction. Mistress Shaw, Alfred Woodard's character, I guess she wasn't really discussed in the memoir. Mm-hmm. So, the McQueen, Steve McQueen and, John Ridley, I believe mm-hmm. his name. They decided to give the character voice. So they kind of used some license in creating the dialogue for, Mistress Shaw.
What do you guys think that was important for them to do that?
Because it was probably very interesting life to be living, to be a slave and then to grab the attention of this white man who probably, did he own her?
Yeah.
Yes.
Owned her. That there's a story to be told there. Mm-hmm. And there's, you also want to be thinking like, okay, so you were in this position where you were being ordered around, where you were being whipped. So now you're in the position where you are ordering around mm-hmm. and you are your, I don't know, she actually whipped, but she, who knows
she has her servant.
She has her servants, you know?
I saw it as Solomon, because he had his wife and he had that respect and that relationship and that. And I saw it as a sort of juxtaposition of what that honest love and respect actually was to what the best they could do as mm-hmm. women, right. as slaves, mm-hmm. so to speak, in that situation. Mm-hmm. And how, as somebody being free, having existed, I imagine that he would look at that like, obviously he loves her because he pretty much would have to give up everything, mm-hmm. yeah. so right, to speak, to sure. be with her. Mm-hmm. But that's really the best he can offer her mm-hmm. is to be alone with him and sort of have her people serve her. And mm-hmm. that's as good as it gets yeah. for mm-hmm. a slave woman in the South.
Good point. Good point. And also it could be too that there's so many different stories to be told. Mm-hmm. There's so many different narratives. There's so many different positions that folks hold regardless of the time. And we see that with Solomon in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So just to think about that period of time and only think about the slaves that are in the field, mm-hmm. it gives us an opportunity to know that there are other multi-dimensional mm-hmm. characters that were in existence even during that time,
mm-hmm. time period,
and their experience yeah. may not have been quite so dismal. So mm-hmm. it gives a little bit of a balance in terms of female representation, even yes. in the 1800s.
That's right. a good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also the other scene, which I wasn't sure. I discussed with the ladies on an alternate title for the scene, but I ended up just coming up with the fingering scene.
The which one?
The fingering scene.
Oh yeah.
So that was a work of fiction. McQueen said he just wanted to show a bit of tenderness. The idea that this woman reaching out for sexual healing in a way, to quote Marvin Gaye, she takes control of her own body. Then after she climaxes, she's back where she was in back in hell. And that's when she turns and she cries. That scene, I don't know, like,
it
I just remember.
Yeah, it was mostly
it's
sad.
Depressing. But it set the tone for the whole film.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And just, like, his initial, like, not, like, what is going on? Oh, wait, I could see him having the thought of, like, I have a wife, mm-hmm. But I'm here, you know, it's just, and then the decision to go ahead and just give this woman what she wants and what she needs. And
did you guys find it interesting that there was there wasn't a dynamic at all with Solomon with a woman outside of that scene?
I did find that interesting.
12 years and he didn't have any sort of, I guess that would digress, but even if it was just some sort of minor
and especially
aspect to the script.
Yeah, and especially since in that time they were encouraged to get wives and have kids so that, you know, the slave owners had more workers and, you know, it was an industry and you're constantly building. So I did find it interesting that he was never married off or, you know, had any moments with women.
Any tenderness at all with the woman.
Go ahead.
I think it would just take away from him being the displaced husband, though.
Yeah.
You know, coming back to his family. So that would have tainted that.
It would have tainted that a little bit. And I felt like, you know, initially I thought maybe there might be something with him and Patsy that would develop.
But it never really happened.
But I initially thought that something like their connection was different from the others.
I wonder if it's in the memoir at all.
I wonder.
I need to read the memoir.
I would love to.
That's my next project.
Damn.
How would you guys feel if in that situation where, you know, Patsy was begging him to kill her and you're watching her go through all this trauma? I mean, she's traumatized in so many different ways by being a slave, by being raped, by being abused by the wife. And someone begs you over and over. You said in the memoir, it's over and over
multiple
again.
Multiple times.
What do you do with that? I mean, you watch them suffer. Even when he was free and he was driving away in the wagon and he left her behind, and you know what sort of experience she was going to have. What would you do with something like that?
I mean, I think that they became so desensitized to things that it probably was something where, you know, after a while, he was kind of oblivious to it. You know, you probably saw so much heartache and so much pain during that time period. I'm sure there were millions of slaves who were getting whipped who wanted to die, and you hear the screaming. Mm-hmm. You probably become desensitized to it. Man. You know?
I don't know. He wrote about Patsy. I feel like that was like his mental whipping every single time she asked him to do it. Mm-hmm. Because there was a part of him that wanted to help her, but there was a part of him that believed in God and that I don't kill people and that's not who I am. So I don't know if he ever became desensitized. I would think that part of him died having to deal with that.
Watching her.
And the same way that she collapsed at the end of the movie like that. Mm-hmm. Which is why I wonder if they did have anything, if they were each other's comfort in some intimate way. Mm-hmm. And once he was stripped, that was it for her. Yeah. But he had to go.
But he just didn't expound upon that in the story. In the
also, like just that moment of like when, because he chose not to kill her, after she got whipped, she's laying down on the board and she looks up at him crying. And it's kind of like they're telling each other, she's like, see, you should have.
Right.
You should have done what I had asked you to do.
Or even after he got back from being on the other plantation and he came back and her eye was red.
Yeah.
She had clearly just been beat again by, I'm assuming, Mistress Epps. And, you know, she looks at him again like, you could have prevented this.
Mm-hmm. And now you're leaving me. You're leaving me to this dismal life.
Yeah. So some little fun facts for you guys, kind of segueing in from fact and fiction. Most of Brad Pitt's dialogue for Bass was actually pulled directly from the memoir.
A
lot of what he said, I guess, specifically with that scene with Epps and he, that was word for word, which I found very interesting.
Maybe why it felt stilted.
Why
it felt stilted, because it was real, unique to that time, and also unique to that situation, because they weren't just yucking it up, like, outside hanging out.
Also, it was shot in 7 weeks in Louisiana, which, I don't know, it's very quick, especially for a period piece. So, I don't know, I guess they were working on overtime there.
And can you imagine those costumes in that heat?
Because
it was the summer. Yeah. Over 100 degrees plus humidity.
Yeah. Sarah Paulson said she was not supposed to sweat at all. Like, he wanted her to look like the little figurines of a bride on top of a cake. Like, he wanted her to be that stiff, and she was not supposed to schwitz at all, like nothing. And she said it was hot as hell because she has a shoot American Horror Story down there, and she was like, it was nothing compared to what I was.
Maybe that's why she actually got the role. Maybe she was already down there filming. She probably did like a audition.
She said she did have to work for that.
Oh, she did.
They talked about, though, the how the humidity and the heat actually added to them enacting their characters.
Yes.
Because it was very indicative of what the kind of temperatures that the slaves would feel. Mm-hmm. So they sort of embraced it, but it was so exhausting to work. I think it was like 108 degrees or something.
And we never saw 30, more than we never 30 saw days, a right? winter. Right. It was always just hot. It was always hot.
Right. So they were mad and frustrated anxious anyway. So
The film was initially scheduled to be released in late December. So I guess that's kind of like where like award season, mm-hmm. A lot of films do. But they had such great test screenings that they decided to move it up. Mm. So real grateful for that.
Yeah.
Otherwise we wouldn't be here. Let's see what else. Chiwetel Ejiofor. Did I say it right? Did I get it?
Yeah, got it. I knew we'd get it after 2 hours.
He originally didn't want the role. He was intimidated by it, which I think we can all agree we understand.
I can understand why.
Then he quickly changed his mind by focusing on creating the character rather than focusing on the entire story, because it is a lot. Mm-hmm. It is quite an epic of a story. It also helped that with him that the film embraced silence and those moments that we talked about before, mm-hmm. where they just let you, they didn't let you have a release from whatever you were watching that was making you feel uncomfortable.
Right.
So it kind of gave that him the time to kind of realize that Northup wasn't fighting for his freedom. He was fighting for his mind.
The longest time he's just like, looking directly at you.
At you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That speaks. Mm-hmm.
They said that he also went to, there's a slave museum in the southern part of Nigeria. So when he got this role, he went there, and once he went there and, you know, got a chance to get exposed to the kind of experience, and he came back and thought, okay, I want to do this.
Yeah.
I need to do this.
Mm-hmm. He said that this role has changed his life like no other role he's had before. Mm-hmm. So
just to embody that, you know, it just has to be such, as harsh as it is, such a spiritual voyage that you go on to embrace that role in that form, you know what I mean? Just, it just is deep, you know, just even the, to think that someone can become someone of that time period and not actually live that time period, but can convince us and show us what it was like to live like that and do it in a very believable way.
Mm-hmm. And to transform.
And to transform.
In front of our eyes in 2 hours from, you know, the upscale, well-to-do gentleman of the North to, you know, slave being beaten south.
It's like us walking out of here and being sold into slavery, walking to our car.
That could still happen. That could still happen. There's sex slavery. There's child labor. There's still slavery, people.
Well, thank you, Siobhan, for those facts. Those
no problem.
Facts and fiction. We are concluding down to the end of the story. Thank you for going on this voyage with us. I just want to get like one quick quote from everyone on a rating of 1 to 5 for the movie. Teresa?
4.25.
Okay.
Very Siobhan. Specific. I like it.
Yeah.
Big old 5.
I'm giving 4.5.
Courtney?
5.
I have to go with 5 just because of the emotional connection I felt after leaving that movie. Okay, now, where can your fans find you? Because you're going to have a lot after talking about this movie today. I know that you also have your own documentary that you've directed and produced called Buckism to Barackism, Reimagining Black Masculinity and Manhood. So if people want to learn more about that and what just all about you, where can they go?
If you want to know more about that particular film, Buckism to Barackism, @gmail.com, I would love to hear from you. Send me an email. I can give you some information about the film. I can tell you how to get in contact with me, but that would be the best starting point.
Okay. Are you on Facebook or no Twitter?
No Twitter. Okay. I don't tweet at this point. I'm going to get a team of tweeters.
You're going to
make your students do it.
Exactly.
And Siobhan?
You can find me on Twitter @Siobhan_Hughes. You can also check out my website at SiobhanHughes.com.
And I'm on Twitter and Instagram @TheTianaHopson.
And Courtney. I'm on Twitter and Instagram @StuartStarlet because somebody took my name.
I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook under Dario Christen. Please find me. Thank you guys for tuning in to 100% Real and our thorough breakdown of 12 years. I want to give a special shout out to our guest, Professor Dr. Teresa Renee White, for joining us and giving us so much input on the film and your viewpoints about it. We really appreciate it. Thought you gave some great comments.
Thank you for having me.
Look out for us for the next 100% Real movie that we'll be doing. We don't know what it is yet. It's TBD, but we will be doing it soon.
We'll tweet it.
Tweet it. Yeah, thanks for tuning in.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, Dario Kristen, and the entire BHL staff, we would like to thank you for tuning in to the Black Hollywood Live Network. If you have questions or comments, tweet us at BHL Online or email us at info@blackhollywoodlive.com. For more exclusive content, visit blackhollywoodlive.com. This has been a presentation of the Black Hollywood Live Network.
Hollywood redefined.
The views expressed here are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of BHL or its owners or principals.